This is Ben Crenshaw. You're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to more golf on the radio. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Frank Forster, and I am your host. On this podcast, we have had major winners on both the men's and women's side of the game, Ryder Cup captains, world champions, Olympic champions, sports writers of the year, golf teachers of the year, musicians, a Harvard scholar, captains of industry, psychologists, politicians, marketing pioneers, and golf course architects. But today is very special. With us is Matthew Harris. On April 8th, Matthew will be awarded the PGA Lifetime Achievement Award in photojournalism in Augusta, Georgia. Only the fifth person in history to be awarded this prize. Matthew, welcome to Radio Golf Show. It's an honor to have you on the program. Many thanks for spending your time with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We're going to have a good time. First of all, from everyone here that are involved with our podcast, a very heartfelt and warm congratulations on receiving this. What must be called as a tremendous honor.
No, absolutely. And quite honestly, yes, of course, I really appreciate it myself. But I think the most important thing for me is none of it would have been possible without the support of my family, going back to my parents and indeed my grandparents. And yes, my family, you know, my two sons and, you know, their mother and my wife and my brother and my sister. I mean, there's an entourage of family that have all played a role in, you know, allowing me to, you know, quite honestly, indulge in my passion for photography. And this is the result. So really, it's for them, not really for me.
How does it make you feel receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award? I mean, just that word is kind of like a little bit.
Yes, really. It was hard at first to process that in my mind, but one of my very best friends, Nick Edmund, who actually is responsible for a charity called Global Golf for Cancer. It'd be worth your viewers checking that out. Just go on Instagram and find him. But Nick wrote me a beautiful note, really just reminding me that this isn't just any award. It is for your lifetime's work in what you do. And he's right. Once I'd processed how he had explained it in his note, I kind of understood the depth of the achievement, and I'm extremely grateful for the PGA of America to, you know, recognize photographers, because they've had a similar award for writers now for, I don't know exactly how long, but certainly probably 30 or 40 years at least. Yeah, much longer.
Do you remember where you were when you found out?
It took me a bit by, it's one of those things. I literally got a phone call from the president of the PGA, but the vice president of the PGA. I didn't recognize his voice at first, and then he explained why he'd called. And when I put the phone down, I was quite honestly kind of a bit stunned and amazed, but at the same time extremely, you know, grateful. And yes, it was, I think it was, it was in the afternoon, and you know when you're least expecting that kind of a phone call. Not that I was expecting it at all,
right?
But yes, it was a thrill for sure.
Cool. You were born in Watford, England, correct?
I was.
Yeah, what year was that?
1960, but I've never supported Watford Football Club, albeit
Let's
at the
hope
beginning of
Elton.
my career, I used to do a lot of games at Vicarage Road.
Oh, okay, let's hope Elton John is not tuning in.
No, I'm probably not. I don't think he's much of a golf fan.
Maybe not, I don't know. 1960. What's your earliest childhood memory?
Causing chaos in my parents' back garden, my father having put grass cuttings in a perfectly good pile at the bottom of the garden, and me then going down and throwing it around everywhere.
Actually, your first memory is getting into trouble.
Yeah, pretty much. I think I was probably about 3 or 4 at that time. And it wasn't, the memory doesn't link with the film clip, but because I made a habit of that, I have actually got a film clip of me doing that, that my, I think my mother, shot.
Right. Beautiful.
She then followed that up with telling me, you generally cause a lot of chaos in the back garden, because when you're about, I think I was probably 14 months. So basically, the garden had a platform at the top of the garden, and then it ran down to a slope to an apple orchard. And one day, so what my mum used to do was put the pram on this flat spot, not near the edge, but I was bouncing around so much, I actually careered right down the slope and crashed into the apple orchard. And that's where she found me, while she was working in the kitchen. So, yeah, I couldn't really keep still too much, apparently.
How old were you when you developed this passion for photography?
Well, I was very fortunate that both my parents were journalists. So it was really very common in our house that there were lots of newspapers, magazines, lots of pictorial references. Although my father was a journalist, he could have gone in either direction. He was a very talented photographer. He had a really good eye, as does my youngest son, Damien, although that's not what he does either. So I was probably taking it pretty serious by the time I was 12, 13. And then at 14, my father and I think this is a ruse for him to replace, we always had a reasonable camera, but he hadn't probably replaced this for probably 15 years or something. And I think it was a bit of a ruse to, get a more updated camera. But anyway, the long and short of it is that we went 50-50 on buying a new camera. It was actually a Pentax SP1000. And the deal was that if I lost interest, he'd pay me back and vice versa. And in actual fact, 6 months later, I paid him, the other half, because I was hooked by that time.
I remember, and I'm born in 61, so we're pretty much the same age. I remember when I was maybe 75, 76, 77, that 77, 15, 16, something like that. One of my best friends was really into photography. And one of the most exciting things was that he had this dark room in his garage, these lights, and I was doing other things. I had absolutely no interest in that. And hanging putting them in the different
Yeah, the
trays
prints
and
hang
things
them on
like
the
that.
line and everything.
Yeah, did you do that as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And I was extremely fortunate that, although I was, what would be the appropriate word that we can not bleep?
We're
I
not
wasn't
losing
particularly academically inclined at
any.
school. But bizarrely, my maths teacher, who knew I was awful at maths, actually ran the photography club. And so, at quite a young age, I had an introduction to doing colour and processing Cibachrome prints. And although there wasn't at m that school I was at the time, a qualification in photography, he gave up trying to make me better at maths, but he really, really supported me in trying to be a better photographer and, you know, understanding the technical side, if you like. Mm-hmm. So that was really helpful. And the thing that really got me going and gave me sort of impetus was the year, and this was probably only 8 months after we got the camera, I actually paid to get into Wimbledon and started taking some pictures on the outside courts, you know, where which you were allowed to do. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you didn't get access to the show courts. But very, very late in the day, I took a picture of Billie Jean King mm-hmm. when she was wearing a white dress. And the rules at Wimbledon then was you could only wear white. However, typical Billie Jean, and quite rightly, she said, well, I'm not going to quite do that. She had a dress on that had strawberries on it as well. So it was obviously red as well as white. Anyway, I got a picture of her at the top of her serve with a ball frozen on the racket. But what really made the picture, I mean, that was okay. But I noticed this little kid. So the background was black because in the outside courts there are tarpaulins. Mm-hmm. And this little kid, he was probably only six, he pulled the tarpaulin back. And his face was lit, just sort of peering through, watching Billie Jean play tennis. And that picture actually won me second prize in the Ashi Pentax Club of Great Britain's, you know, annual competition, which was open to any kind of photographs. It wasn't just sport, mm-hmm. you know, so I was up against dogs and landscapes and goodness knows what. And that got second prize. So that kind of gave me a belief that, you know, I really did have an eye, you know, because at the time that certainly was a competition that was, you know, heavily.
Maybe this is a good point to jump into one of the topics as we continue through your life, because I'm coming from a family of journalists. I think it wasn't a surprise to you that you could actually make money with your passion. It's much more than a hobby, of course.
Yes.
But what you just said, I mean, I guess you can prepare, and specifically about sports photography, you can prepare as much as you want. What factor does luck or chance play of being in the right place at the right time? You don't know what side of the green to be on, where to be. Would that be a fair statement, that luck and chance plays a role in getting that shot?
To a degree, but what I would say is that it's like most things. If you've done your homework, as in, you know, who are the players, how do they react if they're celebrating, how do they react if it's a negative reaction to something going wrong, what's the interaction between themselves and the caddy, you know, in other words, what direction might they, you know, some people will run around, some people will, you know, spin, some people will put their head down, which we hate, by the way. We don't like any sports person putting their heads down, because you don't necessarily see a, you know, good reaction. Mm-hmm. Yes, there is still, of course, an element of luck, but I think in the main, in other words, a very large percentage, it's down to your homework, and it's down to, you know, perhaps visualizing the course you're at, the 18th green, what might work in terms of a lens and a mm-hmm. depth of field. So in other words, that's how much from the subject to the background is or isn't in focus. And, you know, there's a mixture of things at play right. that have nothing to do with luck.
And even if you are in the right
place at the right time,
yeah, even if you are in the right place at the same time, you still have to deliver the shot.
Yeah, no.
I can be in the right place at the right time, and I'll come back yes. with a picture. Who knows?
And quite honestly, I'd say at least 80% of the time, even if you've predicted those things quite accurately, mm-hmm. quite often, in particularly at majors and Ryder Cups, where you know the emotion, whether it be positive or negative, is cranked up to a different level. You've got to, it reminds me of what my driving instructor told me the first time I got in the car. And he said, listen, before we go through anything, and yes, I know you've been, you know, driving around with your mum and dad, because both my parents were, you know, I would call them above average drivers and so on. He said, there's one thing I'm going to tell you, and don't ever forget it ever, is always expect the unexpected. And that's a good mantra for any sports photographer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What characteristics distinguish a great photo from a good one or a mediocre one? And what specific are the challenges of sports photography in general?
Well, if we just put aside, let's say, indoor sports, where you're in a much more controlled environment with the lighting. So let's just put aside indoor sports, you know, whether that be snooker, darts, whatever. You've still got to, you know, bear in mind all the other things I'm going to say. But the one thing that you are effectively have got no control over is what Mother Nature is deciding to do with the weather. Mm-hmm. So you really do need to be, you know, in the film days, you needed to be prepared, you know, not just wandering around with film that was perfect for lovely afternoon light or first light in the morning. You needed to be ready for some, you know, completely awful weather. For example, when, you know, Nick Faldo was won one of his Masters, I mean, there was almost not a film built in transparency terms to cope with how horrific the light was. Under this umbrella of, you know, always expect the unexpected. So have the best film. I even used to carry some black and white film, because if it had been that bad, I would have just sacrificed. I'd rather have, you know, a half decent picture of something in black and white than having something horribly murky and blurry and so on. You know, color transparency film, which, you know, for the most part, obviously that was what I was shooting, because I was shooting for magazines and such.
Mm-hmm. Let's just remind the folks of some of the famous photos you've taken. One of my favorite ones is the one of Jack and Arnie arm in arm. I think that's a wonderful photograph. The most recent one must be Rory on his knees on the 72nd hole on the 18th green at Augusta, winning his Grand Slam. And I read a little article about it. After I read the article, it made me look at the photo completely different, with the smile of the caddy, the angle of the flag he was holding, the shadow. That would be one. Then we have Tiger winning the 2008 U.S. Open, which I think was a phenomenal shot. Seve at the 84 Open.
Yeah.
Everybody that's has had a golf club in his hand knows that photo. As famous is probably the video with his fist pumping. And Seve coming out of his shoes mid-swing. Is probably one of my favorite pictures in golf and maybe in sports. Do you have favorite pictures of yours?
Yes, I do, but I don't. I'm obviously asked quite regularly from a variety of directions, you know, do you have a definitive favorite photograph?
Well, let me phrase it like,
is it
Colbert or Jimmy Fallon when he asks, Billy Joel, or Bruce Springsteen, what's your favorite top 10 Bruce Springsteen songs? What are your favorite top three Matthew Harris photos? Let me phrase it that way.
Yes, and I wouldn't put them in as in, one is this, number two is, in other words, in whatever it can be. It can be a top 10, excuse me, yep. It can be a top 10 or so, but not necessarily in the order that I might mention them. But, you know, as you've mentioned, the Rory McIlroy shot from last year's US Masters, you know, where he became a Grand Slam champion. That was one of those photographs to some degree that I knew if it ever came about, I'm not saying absolutely, of course, I'm not saying I predicted exactly what he would do, in what sequence he would do it. But I did know that he would do something unusual, because I photographed Rory since he was an amateur. I've known him since he was probably 14 years old. And I know how resolute and passionate he was about, you know, trying to get to that position. And obviously, you know, everybody knows the history of him at the Masters, how many times he came close and so on and so forth. Anyway, the way things work at the Masters, on a Sunday, we have to get there very early in the morning in order to have the opportunity to put a chair down around the 18th.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily have to do that, but I chose to do that because I had in my mind a particular spot on the 18th where I wanted to try and get that chair down. So I followed
Sunday
that
placement down in the front left with the...
Yes, so I had already decided in my mind that I definitely wanted to put a chair down coming off the tee on the left-hand side of the green because that's... Just probably percentage-wise, the whole time I've done the Masters, the first one of which I did in 1988, so I've seen a few, is percentage-wise, that often does, because of that pin position, you know, makes the best spot. Not always, because mm-hmm. of all the other factors that can happen.
Yeah.
But I just decided, because I definitely felt in my mind there could be a variety of things going on, I felt that was definitely the right place to be. Now, unless he had, obviously what might have happened is he could have, you know, hooked his second shot left, almost onto the chair I was at, and then everybody would have to be moved and so on and so forth. But, you know, there's all sorts of things are possible, especially in golf. But on the basis, I thought, right, okay, well, I'm going to go there. I'd even got to the point, even before play had started, well, I'm going to shoot it on this lens, and if the light is right, and to a degree, even it wouldn't have mattered had it been, you know, we were lucky. The light was absolutely perfect for that time of day. So you had a choice of doing a variety of things. But I'd already decided if that was the case, I knew exactly what lens I was going to use. I knew exactly what aperture I was going to shoot it at. And I knew I was going to shoot it landscape, not upright, and so on and so on. So a number of decisions I'd already made on the basis that he was on the green.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, everything unfolded as it did, and it turned out to be exactly the right decision.
Mm-hmm. Did you know immediately how good that photo was?
In a sense, not. Because there were, you know, first of all, he made the putt. Then he spun the, you know, the putter up above his head. You know, then he dropped to his knees. And so even from the angle I mean, I missed certain things because other things happened when he got to the top of the green and when he exited. Well, you can't run round Augusta. Indeed, you can't run around at any major championship to get to a second position and then a third position.
Right.
You know, you're basically locked into where you've decided to start the process. But no, I mean, obviously, yes, we're shooting on digital cameras and you could stop and look, but I didn't even look at anything at all until, quite honestly, I didn't until I got to. So the media center is away from the golf course. You get on a buggy and get taken up there. It was only when I got to the scoreboard, which is just before you get on the buggy, that really I looked at it in any detail. I had a quick look before the green jacket presentation, but you know, you've got to just concentrate on what's going on.
Right.
We refer to, if you're constantly looking like this, we call it chimping amongst us. Well, if you're chimping and concentrating on the camera, you're not concentrating on what's going on, and you could miss something. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. How many of you photographers, photojournalists, are there in the pool at the Masters?
I honestly don't know exactly, but I would, if I was to estimate it, maybe around 80 or so, something like that. I don't know precisely, yeah, but
from all over the world, obviously.
Yes, yes, and the agencies and so on.
Does the fact that there are no cell phones allowed at Augusta make it different, or?
No, definitely it does. I mean, yeah. I think it's a good thing.
How so?
I mean, not because I think that people having cameras would affect what we're getting, because you can't compare what you. I mean, yes, modern phones are good at taking a photograph, but you know, you can't compare a photograph taken on a 135 at 1.8 or something compared to a 600 and so on and so forth to a mobile phone.
Right.
So.
Well, you know, some say that technology has made us all photojournalists. Everybody's walking around with an iPhone. And
yes, to a degree. But, you know, I wouldn't go into the detail of it. But I think there's, you know, I think that if people want to just get a couple of tips, even if it's taking their pictures on a phone, is I still think that the background is the most important thing, because if you've got a background that is noisy, too busy, has too many uprights and so on, it disturbs you looking at what, as a photographer, you want people to concentrate on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So background first, yes, of course, exposure, composition, absolutely. Again, I'm not putting them in necessarily, well, you know, number one is the background, but the real fundamentals, I think, are think about your background, think about your composition. You know, the old adage of a third, a third, a third, you know, often doesn't go too far wrong. You know, so for the amateur, that's a good start for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So... Yeah, and just you always want your eye drawn, I think, to a photograph. It's the same as a painting. You want your eye drawn in the first instance to what you as a photographer artist want people to take in first. And then you can always stand back from a photograph or a painting and, you know, see other things.
Right.
And as artists and photographers will tell you over millennia, yeah, well, you've overanalyzed it, you know, that's not what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
but the yeah. fundamentals are you need people to stop and think and go, either, you know, read about what's going on, or just go, wow, you know, that really has held my attention enough, I want to see more or know more.
Visual storytelling. So that's
yeah.
That's one of the Matthew Harris, one of three photos that are in your top 10. What would be another one?
Another one would be a feature picture that I did with Padraig Harrington at the height of, you know, his powers of winning major championships.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'd know Padraig from fairly early on, but, you know, you have to navigate. Time is always the biggest problem, but fortunately, I put an idea to Padraig. So, of course, all golfers practice, but his work ethic was renowned.
Mm-hmm.
On tour amongst other players and so on. And I said, look, what I'd really like to do, if at all possible, I really want to do this sort of portrait feature picture of you in Ireland. And, you know, I know that you've been practicing at the European Club, which at the time was built and owned by Pat Ruddy. The European Club is just south of Dublin on the coast. It's a terrific links course. And I said, ideally, I'd really like to do. So I knew he went there to practice. He didn't just turn up, you know, 2 days a year, the week before the Open. He did go there on a reasonably regular basis. I said, look, is there any chance that we can do a portrait? And I've just got an idea, you know, of having you on a green and have a few, you know, golf balls on it and so on. I didn't give him the absolute detail. And he said, no, that's great. Definitely, we'll do that. Anyway, we got it all organized. But what he didn't know, and I'm ever thankful for the lads at Titleist Island, I actually had laid out over 1,000 golf balls on a green. So when he arrived, he says, I won't do his accent. He says, Matthew, what's going on? He said, I hope you're not expecting me to hit all of these balls. I said, no, absolutely not. I want you to imagine you're a surfer, and I want you to kind of surf over this, blanket of golf balls on the green. And I think probably the best frame of it is actually an upright shot I did of him, where you can clearly see just golf balls all over the place. So it's a full length shot, head to foot, little bit of space under his feet and space underneath. And he's literally pretending, which I asked him to do, just pretend you're almost, skidding and falling over the golf balls. And he's looking right in my lens when he's doing this, and it just makes a picture. And equally, I've got a landscape shot of it where you can effectively see more of the golf course, and it almost looks like he's ice skating over the golf balls. I mean, he really got into it. He was absolutely brilliant. He
No.
really, really was.
I gotta search that out. Maybe this is a good point to talk about, and going back to your youth, at one point you realize, wow, I can really make some money with this, with the living, make a living doing this, what I love doing. And you just said you organized a shoot with Patrick Harrington, and Titleist was involved. How does your business work? Do you are you you're a freelancer? People
Yes.
send you on assignments. Can you just walk us
Yes,
through that a little
it's
bit?
a mixture of things. So early on, again, this is because of my parents' connection with journalism. They were both professional journalists. But I remember very clearly sitting down with my father, because he was actually editor of the Times Business News in London. And so he got involved in, you name the business, at different points. He was in, he did stories about it. So whether that was the oil industry or sports or whatever, but I said, well, look, the way things are, you either work for an agency or a newspaper, or you specialize as a freelance, and you need to pick a sport. You can't do everything. And I said, I'm thinking that golf might work anyway, because of information he had about how things had started to grow. So we're talking about back in sort of 83, so very early on in my career, even though I was doing a whole variety of things. So when I was fortunate enough to get assignments from the Daily Telegraph and the Observer, for example, I was always pushing to say, hey, why don't I go down to Wentworth this week? And so what I used to do is I used to get there extremely early in the morning. I used to shoot color film for me. Anything I did, it was my copyright. And so I went there shooting color material. I'd shoot the assignment that I needed to do in black and white. I'd dash back into Fleet Street, process everything. And, I wasn't compromising the story for the newspaper, because the writer will have said, oh, I need something of, Faldo, Lyle, Woosnam, whoever it might be. That's how that evolved, really.
Yeah, well, it was the time of the Big Five in the mid 80s.
Yes, absolutely.
Heavy. I mean, it was
Yeah.
a beautiful time.
Yeah. No, I mean, Sevier was definitely the catalyst of that. And I was fortunate. I had retainers with magazines in Sweden and the Netherlands and Germany. Germany, I'm not just saying it because I'm on a German podcast. Germany over the years has been extremely good to me. I used to work for Stefan Engart at Golfers Journal. I'm still working with that, now merged with Golf Magazine, and the whole team there is, they've been absolutely terrific. And I've had other German clients, whether that be Hugo Boss or whoever. They've all been, I've done bits for Mercedes, bit for BMW. They've been really very good to me. So I'm
Shout
forever
out to the
grateful.
folks at Golf Magazine.
Yeah.
So, okay, we got Rory is Grand Slam, Patrick the surfer, and
Yeah.
what would be the third one
Well,
you're fond of?
no, I think for sure is really what kick-started me you know, push me ahead of whoever else was starting around that time is the picture of Seve from the 18th at St Andrews in 1984 when he celebrated, which I was covering for the Observer newspaper. I can never thank Eamon McCabe, who was the chief sports photographer at the time at the Observer. So I was what basically used to happen is I would be doing the whatever the second sports story was on a Saturday, I would go and do that. So he might be at the Grand National, for example, you know, Aintree in Liverpool. That's the big main story. But I might be at an Arsenal Spurs match in London or something. Mm-hmm. But I'm forever grateful to Eamon because he, you know, I said to him, look, is there any chance? I knew he would only be doing St Andrews on the, he did St Andrews in 84 on the Friday and the Saturday, effectively a feature picture for the Sunday, you know, for the Sunday paper of the Observer. And I said, look, is there any chance whatsoever that, so I skipped doing that Saturday in order to get to St Andrews. And then I was able to shoot the Sunday for the Observer. So because they didn't need the pictures the next day, I was essentially able to shoot that pretty much in colour. I did shoot some black and white, and then got that picture, which some others did, but it always amazes me. And of course, sometimes I'm on the, you know, on the other side of this, is that although I don't know, there could be 120 photographers, you know, sometimes it might only be three or four or five people that actually get the moment. Mm-hmm. And I think that year to be one of those few that just got the moment. And there's just this one frame.
Yeah.
Is, you know, yeah. His fist is back. Everything works about it.
Yeah.
So in other words, as a sculpture, if you like, is his arm in the right place? Is the putter in the right place? Is his expression right? And so on and so forth. I've just got that. Although it's a sequence of, say, four or five pictures, you know, which, as I say, a few other people did get in the right way. But, you know, this one particular frame is the one that's been used, yeah, you know, the most over the years.
Yeah. I mean, people that know with golf know that photo.
Yes, absolutely.
It's really a phenomenal photo.
Yeah, and the other person who I've, as I say, there's whatever, half a dozen or so people that got a particularly good version, but, you know, the late, great Phil Sheldon, you know, also got, from a similar angle to me, you know, a good frame. You know, as did Dave Cannon. Again, slightly different position to me, but as I say, there aren't that many that got it at the right angle and so on. And of course, there's an element of luck in that. Yeah. You know, at that stage, I didn't have that much experience of how Ballesteros celebrated. I mean, he could have easily just spun round
the other way,
and you'd have missed. Yeah, he might have spun round and, you know, celebrated to the crowd on the other side, in which you'd have got very little.
I guess that says that, you know, placing your chair at Augusta where you did is really something that you can't learn. I mean, if it's something that intuition that, you know, you can't teach me that.
No, I mean, it sounds, it is sort of straightforward. But as I said, even if I took all the masters I've done since 1988, mm-hmm. percentage wise, you are going to get the best angle of a celebration in the first instance from that left-hand side, you know, which is roughly being in the middle of the green sort of position.
Mm-hmm. Other than the Masters and the Open, is there a tournament that you particularly enjoy going to?
I just love the majors and the Ryder Cup because it's like golf cranked up in every sense. You know, whether that's people being on edge, you know, being nervous, can they handle the situation? I mean, again, I'm not necessarily putting it in the top 10, but, you know, the Ryder Cup, actually one of the pictures I was most pleased, I just knew, obviously I'm not suggesting that there are some Ryder Cup captains that are not passionate about what they're doing. They all are on both sides. But there's definitely certain individuals that, you know, I could roughly, of all the captains I've witnessed since 90, I've done every Ryder Cup since 1985.
Well, that was the big one that started it all.
Yeah, it was in a sense, although I wish I'd been there at 83, because in a way that started it, because it gave Europe the belief that they could beat the Americans. Anyway, I think people are beginning to understand now, if they didn't, but, you know, the American captain, having read some of his comments, you know, because they lost it to Bethpage.
Yeah.
I think he's one of the captains that was ultra passionate about the Ryder Cup. And I knew that. And I also knew how calm, cool, and collected, even if one day he'll tell you on a podcast, I'm referring to Luke Donald, of course, yeah, he'll tell you, well, yes, I might have looked like that on the outside, but, you know, I was scrambling like a duck underneath.
Yeah.
But he is. Again, I've followed him since his early career.
And then
it's very difficult to get the two captains together. I mean, unless you were on the radio, the team radio, which of course nobody can be from the media, you don't know when they're going to be in the same place at the same time and so on and so forth. But I did manage to get a frame of the two of them together and Luke Donald. So it's a portrait shot and Luke Donald is slightly standing forward of the US captain. Sorry, I'm just in the middle of, what's his name, if you see what I mean?
Keegan Bradley.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. I love that photo.
There's just something about, A, the fact that Donald is slightly in front of him, and there's just a edge and a nervousness and there's something about, even in a Seals photograph, about Keegan's body language. Because, and quite rightly, you can understand from the American point of view, my goodness, you know, one for ages. I mean, I don't think anybody can. I mean, at the end of the day, I've had this from people in Ryder Cups and saying this from the players.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, when all is said and done, it is down to the players, even if the captain has made all the right decisions with his vice captains. However, during the process of the match, or the matches, the pressure really is on the captain because he's an easy target to go, well, you did the right thing, you did the wrong thing. And I really was quite determined. I wanted to get a picture that sort of resonated that. And even if Luke wasn't, he looked really calm, cool, and collected. And I don't mean, it's not because Keegan was pulling a face or anything like that, but you can just see the tension in his body language.
You can totally understand his emotions.
Yes.
I call it, when I think of it,
yes,
myself, Capitano Luke taking Keegan to school.
Yes.
That would be the title for that photo, but it's a tremendous photo.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know, the way I see it and the way I remember it is that Keegan in the background is even a little bit blurred almost.
Slightly, exactly.
So terrific. So we had Rory, Patrick.
And one thing I would like to add on that, I mean, I gather from things that you read that he is still beating himself up over having lost.
Mm-hmm.
I do hope that he navigates out of that because I can't stress how, you know, beyond passionate he is about the Ryder Cup. And I'm not saying necessarily, you know, being a captain again or whatever, but I still think he's got an awful lot to bring, you know, to the American Ryder Cup team. And you know, I hope he's able to navigate out of this, and I can understand it, you know, still feeling extraordinarily low over what happened.
Yeah, I hope so too. And I think he's still got a whole lot of playing left to do himself as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
We'll see how it works. This might be a good time for I talked to my daughter who's 11 years old, and I said, I got this one of the most famous photographers in the world on the podcast.
You're making me nervous now.
What should I ask him? And shot out of a pistol, she said, ask him, when was the last time he took a selfie? I thought it was brilliant.
Right. So, Jim, who's the producer of a video that the PGA are very kindly putting together, which they have done for previous winners of the award, he said, don't you have any pictures with you with golfers? And I said, no, my job is not to buddy up to this group of people or sports people. I'm there to photograph them, not me with them. I'd say the last selfie was my wife and I on holiday in Greece last year. It's hey. Not something I do.
Right. No. There you go. Well, I'll be sure to tell her because she's not listening.
Please do. And also add that we did have a very good holiday, and where we went, I think she'd really enjoy it. It was a hotel almost hanging off the rocks with a pool, and it had a terrific view. You should take her.
I mean, I can't imagine a dentist going out on the weekend and checking people's teeth in the park. I mean,
no.
Do you go out on your days off and photograph ordinary people?
What would be my, I think, no, not especially. And I think you just have to be a bit wary of, I mean, not necessarily where we were in Greece, but I don't want to take a full blown camera with me. I'd say, so I don't just photograph golf tournaments. You know, I do tournaments, I do features with players, I do golf courses, and I used to do a lot of instruction. So it's four very different disciplines. But I think what, besides, yes, of course, sport was always there at the beginning, but I do still particularly love shooting landscapes. So, you know, I will take pictures wherever we might be, you know, on holiday, vacation, and it's landscapes, not people so much.
Right. You mentioned it's not your job to take pictures with the players, and even though you probably don't have many photographs of you with players, surely you must have developed relationships over the last 40 years or so with these players. I mean, you see them at all the big events; they know who you are.
Yeah. I always feel the easiest way to describe it is we are like a traveling circus. We are all a family. And, you know, like any family relationship, if you are generally doing the right things in a positive way, then everybody gets on. So, you know, any particular time, maybe obviously not so much at the very beginning of my career, but certainly once I was 5 years, well, even less probably, 5 or 6 years into it, you get to know caddies, caddies move around. And so, for example, you know, by the time we get to the late 90s and Tiger coming on the scene as a professional, I didn't really know Fluff. I mean, he knew me, as in he recognized me. I'd seen him at enough majors, but, you know, I didn't know him particularly. But I did know Steve Williams extremely well. So when Stevie Williams started caddying for Tiger, it certainly broke a barrier, as in, you know, because I know full well that, you know, Stevie particularly, you know, kept an eye out on everybody, but he'd certainly let Tiger know, right, no, him, her, we don't need to worry about them. They know what they're doing. And it doesn't mean to say that you would never make a mistake, because at the beginning we're talking about cameras that, you know, weren't Cylons and so on and so forth. But no, that certainly broke the ice in terms of, you know, being recognized by somebody who, you know, became the best golfer of his era. But the same goes for a lot of other players.
Let's talk about you and golf. How did that happen? I know you're a member at Royal Dornoch. And maybe we can combine it with the fact when you first started playing golf yourself, along with the fact that when you really concentrated, you mentioned Billie Jean King, you mentioned landscapes, other things. When you really concentrated on golf courses and golf players and golf tournaments and then golf majors and the Ryder Cup.
Yes. So I turned professional when I was probably 19, even really, because although I went on a photography, film and television degree course, you know, which I completed, but all the way through that I was working for newspapers and started working with some magazines. And I'd already started on, you know, alluding to that conversation I told you earlier with my father about golf. So obviously you don't build up any kind of a file of any sport. It takes time. But that's really when that started. And so, you know, I just transitioned from doing landscapes in the Lake District and the Peak District to making sure that there was a golf course in the foreground or the background of such places. Yes, probably, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years into it. I mean, the other person that would stand out is Bill Robertson, who was the editor of Golf Illustrated. And even though I didn't have, you know, any sort of a back catalogue worth speaking of, I did start because their office was only just round the corner from the Daily Mail, which I would drop sports pictures into, you know, on the desk. I did just go in one day at the right time of day because my dad having the knowledge of when you should go in and see these people. Because often if you ring up, you'll never get in. It's better just to walk in as if you're supposed to be there and then just knock on the door, which is what I did with Bill. We had a short chat. I brought him some golf pictures. He said, oh, right, no, this is interesting, yeah. And then he started to use my golf pictures regularly in Golf Illustrated. And then he moved on. And, you know, he really gave me my really big break in golf when Today's Golfer magazine started in 1988. And I was there for the first 10 years, essentially as the, you know, lead chief photographer for that magazine.
Let me maybe to get a different angle from that topic. Why do you personally find golf courses and golfers so interesting to photograph compared to, let's say, Liverpool, Everton?
I think it's in a sense, I know you can go to football training and so on and so forth, but even going years back, that was not always easy access. I think it's the variety. You know, as I mentioned earlier, it's a very different discipline to be shooting instruction with a golfer, to shooting a golf course, to shooting a tournament itself, and to shoot features with players. You know, I worked as an assistant in London for what one would describe as a GP photographer and a still life photographer. So there's all sorts of lighting skills that you picked up and all that sort of thing. I love the fact that there was the variety, that you weren't constrained to a football pitch, you know, albeit to a degree you can move around a bit, you can get up in the gods and so on and so forth. You know, and all the different, yes, I know some football grounds look slightly different, but in essence, they're not, they're all the same.
Right.
You go to a golf course by the ocean, a links course, you go to one under the mountains and so on and so on and so on. There's just such massive variety. You know, and when all is said and done, I'm very much an outdoor person. So to be, you know, outdoors in the elements, you know, in a whole different variety of landscapes, that's great. Thank you very much. That's what I'll do.
Right. But I guess that means that a great golf photojournalist is not necessarily a great football photojournalist.
No, not necessarily. Although I think, because I've seen it happen from time to time, is if you're a really talented sports photographer and you've got an exceptional eye, you can go and photograph any sport and you will come away with something above average and in some cases exceptional. You know, I know without naming names, if I got one of the top F1 photographers to go and do golf, I know that they would come away with something that you'd just go, oh, wow, that's terrific.
Wow. I didn't expect that. That's
Yeah.
great. That is.
Without, I have no doubt about that in my mind at all.
Wow. We do have some equipment nerds listening to this podcast, apparently. And
Right.
would you give us a little taste, if you will, of what gear you are using when you go to a major or to a Ryder Cup? What's in your bagage?
Yes, so for tournaments, it could be a mixture of it'll be two camera bodies. I shoot Nikon, I have done all my career, so right now I'm shooting with two Nikon Z9 bodies. And then I've got 14 to 24, 24 to 70. So those are zoom lenses. I've then got an 85 f1.2. I sometimes use a 135 1.8. So those are fixed focal length, not zoom lenses. I use a 180 to 600 zoom lens, but I also use not all the time, not as much as I might have done back in film days. But I also shoot a 600-4,
Well, there you go.
which is huge. I mean, that is even now, even though it's become much lighter, it's probably half the weight
Yeah,
of a
I've been seeing
600 I might
pictures
have used at the
with this
beginning of my
lens
career.
on your back. That's like a half a meter, more than half.
Yes, yeah, I mean
It's huge.
yes, and it's even today it's heavy, but
Right.
as I say, it's half the weight it used to be 35 years ago. And then, you know, not just for golf landscape photography, but you know, golf course photography, but I will have a 90 generally, and I may use it at a tournament from time to time, but not excessively. Two lenses I might use from time to time would be a 16 millimeter fisheye and also a 19 millimeter tilt shift. So, in other words, a tilt shift, for those that don't know, it's a lens that architectural photographers do to, you know, get the lines appropriate for the buildings that they're shooting in the interiors. But that creates quite an interesting effect, you know, both for tournaments and particularly for golf course landscapes.
Of course. And I think this might be a good hook into how your perspective on professional photography, professional sports photography has changed over the years with the technologies and things like this.
Yes, well, in some ways, I feel actually very fortunate to have been born when I was, because I've seen and witnessed and practiced through an incredible change. You know, I started off shooting film, black and white and color, having to process all of those things. And we're now in a situation of digital photography where you can see what you've shot immediately on the back of your camera. So, yeah, it's been, I know some people along that journey weren't able to make the transitions, but you know, I'm certainly know I could name two or three of my fellow photographers that are, you know, exceptionally good on the technology front. You know, if I was to do it in golfing terms, I'm maybe a 12 handicapper, but I know people that are plus two, you know, on the technical side. So there's many people who are much better qualified than I am. But you know, I was determined just to keep. You've got to, it's like motorcycling. You've got to always expect the unexpected, and you've always got to practice. You know, you've got to keep learning, always keep learning.
You're off to the United States. Good luck customs with all that gear.
You're not supposed to mention that. Can you delete that? Thank you.
I don't know. I guess the name's F this and blah, blah, or the military equipment. Now they're not listening to this. You're going to go and pick up this well-deserved Lifetime Achievement Award. You're going to be covering the Masters?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do they let you into the clubhouse?
No, not now. There was a time where we did get access and we could go and have breakfast, but you know, it's golf tournaments, majors are like golf courses themselves. You know, they evolve, they change, mm-hmm. and the demands on space and all of these things. You know, I don't feel it. Yes, of course, in some ways it's unfortunate. I mean, we used to have a tradition amongst half a dozen photographers that we used to go and have breakfast on a Sunday morning at Augusta National on the final day after we laid out our chairs and done whatever. Do I miss that? Yes. Mm-hmm. Am I angry or otherwise because we can't do it? No, I'm not, because, you know, as I say, things evolve and things change. And I'm just not one of those people that, you know, stand in the pub or a bar moaning that things aren't the way they used to be. You know, if you start doing that, you might as well
move on. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, sure, there were things better in the old days, but
things evolve.
Exactly. Do you hang out, or not hang out is not the right word. Do you go out and look for shots even during the practice rounds and the
party? Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
So
yeah,
you're
yeah,
there the sure. full week?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I actually get there the Saturday before mm-hmm. to do the final day of the women's amateur at Augusta National, which I think is an absolutely terrific event.
I agree. It really is. I agree. Yeah. With you. And I think it's getting the reception it deserves because
totally.
You can see it. People are into it. I think it's true. And when I first heard about it, women's am, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. but it really works. I mean, these guys think about every decision they make very carefully, obviously. And
yes,
they're really, really good decisions. What advice would you have for an aspiring photojournalist?
I would lean immediately to say don't bother, but I've moved away from that. I think the first thing I would say, thankfully, because there's been a period where we really didn't see young people coming into the profession, there's kind of a gap missing of people, mm-hmm. you know, really good talent. I'd say for at least a decade, you know, it's like they went somewhere else. But I think, without going into it, I think, thankfully, there are a variety of opportunities out there now. But I think the most important thing is, you know, don't forget to, yes, you can pick up a digital camera and you can almost go, oh, blink, blink, blink.
Yeah.
I'm exaggerating a bit. Oh, yes, I can autofocus. But it's like probably playing the drums, which I vaguely do a bit. Mm. I can't play them because I've not given it the time, but in other words, I've sat at a drum kit and so on, and I've seen people, and I know two people that play exceptionally well, not professionally, but they play exceptionally well. You know, don't forget, and it's like golf as well, if you start with the fundamentals all wrong, you're just going to be chasing your tail. So do learn about shutter speeds, do learn about apertures and what they mean, understand what depth of field means, because quite honestly, and yes, I'm mainly referring to social media, the majority of what you see on social media is what would be it's awful.
Yeah.
You know, the production values are very, very poor. And the people that have made the effort to understand the fundamentals of photography and the fundamentals of filmmaking are, in the main, having a much better impact and having a much better career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, don't not go to an art gallery. There's so much you can learn from, you know, the greats, and do your research on, you know, photographers that are sadly no longer with us. But there's still some fantastic photographers who are still with us. People like Albert Watson. You know, I often mention these to, you know, youngsters, and they go, "Albert who?" Yeah. Well, if you don't know who Albert Watson is, then quite honestly, I almost feel like you shouldn't be out here with a camera.
Yeah.
Because you will learn so much. You know, he's probably one of the finest portrait photographers and fashion photographers that's existed in the history of photography. He's just exceptional.
Well, there you have it. That's certainly good advice for anybody thinking about or having a passion and not knowing how to go to the next level. Why don't we leave it with this topic, and taking photographs you've taken out of this equation, is there any experience in your experience around professional golf from the 80s until today that stands out, that really impresses you, whether it was something you saw or an interaction you had with somebody?
Yeah, that's actually an easy question to answer.
That's good.
I made a portrait with Gene Sarazen at Augusta National on the, if you like, the first floor outside of, you know, in other words, he was outdoors. He wasn't inside the clubhouse. Mm-hmm. And I've literally got him sitting on a chair, and at that time, this is in the 90s, he had a shooting stick, you know, the one that you can kind of open up and sit on.
Mm-hmm.
So he used to at that time have one of those, and I've got him with the shooting stick sitting down in a chair, you know, like this, and him looking straight into my lens. I shot it on a Nikkor 105 1.8 lens, and it was at 1.8, so that means that the depth of field was really shadow. It was, you know, very, very out of focus. And while I love the photograph, the reason it stands out is that I sat with him for probably around about nearly 90 minutes just talking about life and golf, how he invented the sand iron.
Wow.
And and he was wryly amused, because he did ask me, he said, "Well, who's your golfing hero then?" And I'm sure at the time he probably expected me to say Nick Faldo. And I said, "That's easy, Mr. Sarazen." I said, "That's Walter Hagen." And he just rolled back in his chair, laughing his head off. And I would say for 20 minutes, wow, he told me stories that I can't even repeat to you. They were just gold dust.
Wow.
If there's one time I wish I'd had a, you know, a tape recorder, but it's just a really vivid, warm, privileged memory.
Very cool.
That tops the list, I think. Genius. And I've been very lucky. There's many other things that have been, you know, great fun and a good memory, and, you know, dinners with or incidents with or whatever. But I think that one is at the top.
There you go. I mean, that's a wonderful, wonderful story. I mean, I can just and then you don't need to say any more. There's plenty of things, and I love the Walter Hagen answer. That's terrific. Matthew, thank you so much for taking the time and talking with us, for letting your unbridled enthusiasm roam free and telling stories that are just incredible, to be honest. And I hope you'll be on that traveling circus that goes around the world promoting the game that we all love for many years to come. And I look forward to seeing your work and maybe going around Dornoch with you one time. That would be
yes, no, absolutely, yeah. Make sure you get over here for sure, and we'll show you the links.
There you go.
Safe and indeed, the new clubhouse.
Yes, I talked to Neil about it. Yes, it's awesome. I think, I don't care if he's listening. What he's doing, I think, is so terrific. It's like the CEO of the future.
Yes.
You know, he understands everything from the economics, from the social skills of his staff. I mean, it's just the whole package. And I don't know who wouldn't love to work for that man. So. He's doing everything right too, just like the folks at Augusta.
No, absolutely.
Thank you for your time. Safe travels across the.
Thank you.
Enjoy.
And thanks again for the invitation. It's much appreciated.
It was our pleasure, ladies and gentlemen. That was it. To the Lynx Land.